Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoCillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, July 16th, 2006, and this is show number 52. Well, to my faithful listeners, I have some very disturbing news for all of you. I'm going on vacation. I'm going to be on vacation for 2 weeks, so there will be no NoCillaCast for 2 whole weeks. I know you're devastated, but you do have 2 good options. The first is you can peel back through the archives on podfeet.com and try to find old shows you've never heard. With 52 of them out there, I bet there's a couple you've missed. In addition, I'm going to be posting a couple of shows in my absence, but they won't be me. One of the NoCillaCast fans is a gentleman named Ron David, who does professional voiceovers for a living. If you've ever listened to any U.S. public broadcasting, you've heard Ron's voice. The one I remember him most for is the show about the Titanic on PBS, and I also remember him from Mysteries of the Deep from National Geographic. As a former stunt pilot, one of Ron's hobbies is to hang out with pilots from the early days of aviation. He's the president of the Washington chapter of the Silver Wings fraternity, and through that affiliation, he was able to do a fabulous interview with 94-year-old pilot Faye Wells shortly before she passed away. Faye was a foreign and war correspondent, co-founder of the 99s, the first woman broadcast correspondent to cover the White House. She also served in Africa during World War II, and she even flew with Amelia Earhart. I guarantee you'll enjoy listening to this interview. Faye and Ron clearly have a great deal of mutual respect, and Faye's stories are just simply enchanting. If you enjoy the material, please send an email to Ron at rondavid@gmail.com or write to me and encourage him to get these shows out as a podcast. He's been working a bunch of other issues in his life, like, you know, trying to make a living, and doesn't want to do a botch-up job of podcasting by not dedicating enough time to the effort, but I think maybe he needs just a little encouragement to get started. You can also check out Ron's website at rondavid.com, where you can see some of the material he's done and get in contact with him if you need to have any voiceover done. Now that I've made sure that you're in good hands while I'm gone, let's talk about me. How am I going to survive without internet access for 2 whole weeks? It's going to be gruesome. Of course, I'm still going to bring my MacBook Pro just in case, but we're going on a barefoot cruise in the Caribbean, so on a 275-foot sailboat, so I'm guessing no high-speed broadband. Don't know for sure, but I'm thinking no. But I guess we'll have to suffer through, you know, drinking Mai Tais and laying out on the deck and snorkeling in the sun. But, you know, we'll try to bear up. I did search around the island of Antigua, where we'll be staying for about 4 days, and it looks like we'll be able to drum up some internet access in a bar or a restaurant or sneak into one of the local hotels that has it. Well, I have a geography update. Listener Sebastian explained the difference to me between Tasmania and Tanzania, or Tanzania. I referred to listener Rose as being from Tanzania in Australia. It turns out Tanzania is a country in Africa, and Tasmania is an island off the an island state off the coast of Southeast Australia. Well, it's a good thing I never professed to be good at geography. Sebastian was actually quite shy about correcting me, but I sure hope you all will when I mess up, because otherwise some poor soul could quote me and sound like an idiot. I'm okay if I sound like an idiot, but I want to protect my listeners. A couple of weeks ago, I reviewed a tool called Celestia, which is a Mac-based space exploration application. I did eventually get it to work pretty well with some help from the listener who turned me on to it, and I even got my nerve up to try and run it under Linux. I worked on it pretty hard, but I kind of got tangled up in words like path and make and needing to install GCC libraries. And while, believe it or not, I do understand what those things are, I have zero clue how to actually make Linux do those kinds of things. I may pursue it with some adult supervision, but in the meantime, listener Bill wrote in to tell us about another cool tool to look at the heavens called SkyChart, which comes from Sky and Telescope, the authority on the subject. SkyChart is a cross-platform, Java-based application that runs in your browser. On the Mac side, it runs in Safari, but not Firefox or Camino. And under Windows, it does run under Firefox. If you really want to run it under Internet Explorer, you have to download Java from Sun. Well, it's probably way easier just to use Firefox. That's what you should be using anyway. When you first go into SkyChart, it asks you for your location and time zone, which is how it figures out how to show you what's up in the sky. You can change it later so you can see what the stars look like from different areas of the world. You can also look at the stars at different times of the day and year, which is pretty cool. The main window is the expected circular-looking sky chart with lines outlining the different constellations. As you hover over a constellation, it highlights the entire thing along with the name. There's also a green bordered area you can drag around, and that area becomes highlighted in a smaller window on the upper left. That window can then be maximized so it fills the browser window. You can drag the view around, which is really sort of like you rotating your head around to see what's out there in different directions. To make you understand that you're looking at the horizon, they've put little things along the bottom, such as fences and tractors and little houses. It's really kind of cute, but it does let you know that you're down to the horizon. Along the bottom, it also tells you what direction you're looking, which is perfect so you can match that to where you're looking in the real world. I did run it under the Mac OS and under Windows, and it worked perfectly in both of them. And I did try to run it under Linux, and even though I was running Firefox, it said I had to run Firefox, I had to install Java. Ugh. All right, I tried, I found it, and I downloaded it. I downloaded an RPM, which I've heard is the kind of file that should actually install itself, but then I couldn't figure out where Linux put it. I looked in Firefox, looked to where it said it stored it, and it wasn't there. So I got bored and I moved on again. Maybe I'll noodle around on it later, but at least I verified that it is supposed to work. SkyChart is a really slick program, and it meets the NosillaCast seal of approval by being cross-platform and free. Check it out at skyandtelescope.com/observing/SkyChart. Thanks for the cool tip, Bill. Keep them coming. Listener Mike wrote in and asked me a couple of questions, and I thought some of you might have the same questions, so I'm going to walk through what we talked about. He started his letter off, as all good fan mail should, with some nice compliments. Here's what he wrote. I have really been enjoying your podcast since I found you last May. You have a very professional presentation. Do you do much editing? I never hear a miscue. You must not be listening very closely. I never hear a miscue. I think you might have mentioned what equipment you use, but I could not recall it. Can you point me to the show you discussed it? By the way, I also was a winner in the Mac Companion giveaway and won a nice book collection from O'Reilly. Hey, Mike, congratulations on the Mac Companion giveaway. The odds were really great on that contest. And thanks for the nice words. Believe it or not, I don't do any editing. If you do listen closely, you'll hear me stutter now and then, but oh, what the heck, at least it lets you know I'm human. I shouldn't say that I don't do any editing, because one time when my son came in and hit me in the head with a ball, I sort of said a bad word, so I had to cut that out. Once in a while, I do mess up really badly, but probably 90% of the time, I just record right through. Now, I do script the whole show beforehand, so that's probably why it's relatively smooth. I've tried writing up only bullet points so I could sound more relaxed, but it just didn't work for me. I found myself stuttering and forgetting what I meant to say. Even though if I have another person in the room, I can rattle on a conversation for hours on end and dominate the conversation, you're sitting alone with a microphone and some bullet points, it's a lot harder than it looks. For equipment, I use a Samsung C01U USB microphone that runs around $70. I put a link in the show notes to Sam Ash, which is where I bought it, so you can take a look for yourself. I plug that into the USB on my MacBook Pro, so I don't need a preamp or mixer or anything like that at all. I did originally use a USB headset microphone that came in the box with IBM's Via Voice. I used Via Voice to type for me when I broke my hand a few years back, and it really saved my life. I thought the sound on the USB headset mic was pretty good, but then all these podcasters were talking about how important good sound was. Actually, somebody once said, it's so fatiguing to listen to bad sound. That's when I said, okay, I really got to get that changed. But I was paralyzed by all this talk about mixers and line-in and preamps and powered this, and I just didn't know what a lot of that stuff was talking about. But then I heard about the Samsung C01U. It even says, ideal for podcasting, right on it, on a sticker. So since it didn't need a mixer or a preamp or power, just USB, I figured that was the mic for me. Like I said, I bought it at Sam Ash. I threw in a mic stand, and after tip and tax, I was out the door for $100. Can't beat that. The Samson comes with software that looks kind of like a mixer. It has sliders and a level meter that shows you if you're peeking out on the gain. The whole levels thing is pretty tricky, for me anyway. On the tool, you have to crank up the gain about 30 dB or you won't get any kind of reasonable volume, at least on my PowerBook G4 doing the recording. The other weird thing is that the sliders in the Samson tool, the volume on the system press for sound in, and the volume sliders in your recording tool seem sort of independent, like some of them are kind of actually doing the same thing. When I first started out in this, I was using Audacity for my recording, and in there, the volume is very hinky, getting the levels right. I switched to GarageBand because of that. In Audacity, I had to mess with the levels every single time, and if I'd start out where the sound was too low, so I'd slide it up, and it'd still be too low. I'd slide it up, it wouldn't get any louder until I slid it up till it hit the very top, and then the sound would go through the roof. So then if I backed it off, I could get it back to the right place. Well, I got tired of that, so when GarageBand 3 came out, great for podcasting, I decided that I should go ahead and switch over. Now, every time I go into my GarageBand to record, everything is, I have to toggle a couple of switches, but not too much. Definitely don't have to mess with the levels very much. When I got my Intel-based MacBook Pro, my Samson mic didn't work at all, and the software wouldn't even launch. I emailed tech support over at Samson, and they said to call instead. Oh, I hate that. I like email because I can communicate on my schedule instead of theirs. You know, going, okay, I got to figure out what time they're open, when I can call, when I'm home. You know, it's just hard. I don't like calling on the phone anymore. So I broke down and I called them and I was delighted with the support. The guy who answered the phone knew exactly what was wrong. Turns out the Intel-based Macs don't need the software. In fact, they can't run at all with the software. But he didn't just tell me delete the application. He walked through how to eliminate every little bit of it in every library. He was extremely versed on OS X, and once I got rid of the application, the microphone worked perfectly. Finally, let's get down to the issue of sound quality. I think it's about 20% better than before. You can listen to the difference yourself if you like. Check out show number 25 on January 8th and show number 26 on January 15th. That's in 2006. If you go to my site, you can click on the archives and listen to the shows and see what you think yourself. In GarageBand, after I've done the recording, I then add the music at the front and the back end. The music that you hear is actually a canned jingle from GarageBand called Midnight Dialogue. From there, I send it to iTunes, convert it to an MP3 in iTunes, and then add some stuff to it there, like the picture that shows as cover art. I change the genre to podcast, that kind of stuff. I use Feeder from reinventedsoftware.com to create the RSS feed itself and to write up the script of the show. And then finally, I use WordPress to do the blog. I cut and paste the show notes out of Feeder and I stick them in WordPress. I think that just about covers everything. Hope that answered your question, Mike. If anybody wants more detail on any bit of this, just shoot me an email at allison@podfeet.com. The next topic may sound a bit political, but there was great news this week about open standards. As you know, Microsoft dominates the office automation space, which I actually do think is a good thing. Not that it's Microsoft, but that there is one big company that has the whole market. While I don't believe in the need for a dominant operating system, it really is handy that we can all trade documents around and know that the other person will be able to open them. The next phase we're getting into is finally a world where the application doesn't have to be the same. It's the document format that needs to be standardized. Many government organizations are now pushing for an open standard, not the Microsoft standard. They're reasonably concerned that every document archived of their collective knowledge in the government is in a format owned by one company. Led by the state of Massachusetts, Microsoft has agreed to join the cause and actually support which is now called the Open Document Format. I think this is tremendous news, but I do remain skeptical that Microsoft won't booger this up. Remember how well they supported Java? Anyway, I'm cautiously optimistic about this shift in policy. You can read the entire ZDNet article at a link in the show notes. I'm not really sure how to explain this next website, but it was intriguing enough I wanted to tell you about it. It's called crashmedia.com, and it's one of the oddest sites to navigate. First of all, I have to warn the visually impaired here, this entire site is done in Flash, so you probably want to fast forward through this part of the show. The site is a gallery of the kinds of odd projects that Crash Media has done for people to meet their needs of online businesses, and some stuff that's just for fun. I saw one of the Crash Media guys on Call for Help with Leo Laporte, and in that show he was demonstrating some really interesting hardware hacks that they've done. One example of the interesting things they've done with Flash is to go to their site called webcamtastic.com. This site uses your own installed webcam to mutate your pictures live. You actually drag little things like the old Goo program, you drag around on your own photo, and it's actually the place on the screen that you're dragging, not the place in your photograph. So you can move your head around live before you're ready to take the snapshot and be squiggling on the screen and then hold your head still and take the picture. Again, this is kind of hard to explain, but it's pretty fun. Just to let your brain explore different ways of doing web design, check out crashmedia.com and let me know what you think. I want to make some observations about Windows versus the Mac. Ever since I got Windows running on my Mac under Parallels, I found I've actually been using Windows more and more often. The main reason behind this is that the major applications I use are not yet native to the Intel platform under OS X, but they are native to the Intel platform on the Windows side of the Mac. Have I got you confused yet? It's a little tough. Let me back up for a minute to make sure you're all with me. The new Macs have an Intel processor, so applications that are native to the PowerPC processor of the older machines either have to be rewritten to be native to Intel, that's referred to as universal applications, or else they have to run in an emulation layer. That emulation layer is referred to as Rosetta. Most applications still run on the new Intel-based Macs, but if they're running in Rosetta, they're just crawling compared to what they could be doing. They're not that bad compared to a G4 laptop, for example, but compared to the universal competitors, they're pretty slow. However, many of the applications we all run are also written to work with Windows, which means that in Windows, they are already native to the Intel chip. So even though the applications are running inside Parallels to run on Windows, the overhead of that program is so small that they're nearly full speed. The good news is that I'm learning more and more about Windows. My friends at work laugh at me, though, because I'm such a newbie at it. It's hard to find an adult who hasn't ever really used Windows. I had to ask someone the other day how to get rid of everything on the screen and just see the darn desktop. Turns out it's the Windows key and then the letter D. But on the Mac keyboard, I don't have a Windows key. So I started messing around and doing different keystrokes in conjunction with the D and discovered that if you hold the Option key, Command D, it actually does show you the desktop. So overall, I now think that I have a unique opportunity to compare ease of use side by side as I get more comfortable with Windows. Here's one thing that really illustrates how the legacy of Windows is a big downfall for it. OS X has the dock where you can drag applications down into it so that they can be accessed with one click when in any application. Windows has identical functionality in the quick launch bar. Okay, so far so good. On OS X, to add an app to the dock, you open the applications folder, which is filled only with, what would you think, applications, and they have names like Word, Excel, etc. So drag the icon for the application right down into the dock, and the applications move over to make room for it at your desired location. On Windows, I tried to do the same thing. I opened the Programs folder, and in there I found a whole bunch of other folders, not named by the name of the applications, but by the name of the company who created them. All right, not a big deal, but that means I have to go to a folder deeper than I did within OS X, and I have to know the name of the company that wrote the software. Not too hard since we're looking for Microsoft Word in this example. So I open the Microsoft Office folder, and now there's still more folders. Okay, annoyance is going up a notch, but at least one of them is called Office 10, so I figure that will have my applications. I open up Office 10. What the heck is all this garbage? There's 87 files and folders in the Office 10 folder. How am I supposed to find the applications in there? All right, I'll sort alphabetically and find Word down at the bottom. I did find something called Word.pip, but that can't be it. It should have a .exe at the end, I'm thinking. Wait a minute, what's right this above it? Called WinWord.exe? You gotta be kidding me. They don't call it Word. They call it WinWord. I complained to a buddy of mine about that, and he said it was because there used to be a version of Word that ran under DOS. So when they came out with the Windows version, they called it WinWord. Can you believe that? Oh my gosh, how far back is that? That's got to be, 12, 13 years, 14 years ago, something like that. Anyway, PowerPoint isn't called PowerPoint either. For some equally obscure reason, I'm sure, they took the latter vowels out of it, and it's PowerPoint, PowerPoint.exe. Thank goodness at least Excel was in there normally. And it left me thinking, what are the other 84 things in this folder? Does anybody know? All right, to be fair, I did bring this up to another friend of mine, and she said the way normal people do it is they pull up on the Start menu, go over to Programs, and then over to Office XP. Oh, now, that's interesting. It's called Office XP, which makes sense, not Office 10 like it was in the other folders. And then they pull over to the Applications, which are actually normally named, and then drag that icon over to the Quick Launch Bar. Well, that was way easier, but I'm still wondering about those 84 files, aren't you? I'll bring up comparisons from time to time, and I promise to tell you things I like better about Windows just as soon as I find them. Just kidding. Mostly. Research Department Niraj is actually in Sweden right now, but that didn't slow down his sending some very interesting applications from his BlackBerry. I tell you, this guy surfs more effectively on his BlackBerry than I do on a laptop. He said it was a long train ride in Sweden that let him get so much done. In any case, let's take a look at what Niraj submitted to us this week. First up is WIMP from greenkeepersoftware.com. WIMP is a Mac-only application that solves a niche problem. If you'd like to connect to your home Mac from other locations, you need to know its IP address. Well, today's broadband IP addresses are relatively static, but they do change after a while, and that's when you'll need WIMP. WIMP runs in the background and checks regularly to see what your IP address is and sends you an email whenever it changes. It even allows you to have the email sent to more than one address if you like that feature. It's available in English, German, Spanish, French, and Japanese, and they're looking for volunteers to translate all user-visible text into other languages. You do have to leave your Mac on for WIMP to do its work, but then again, if you're connecting into your Mac, you do need to be able to get into it. But you don't have to be logged in to do that. That feature is what allows WIMP to perform a second function. If your computer is ever stolen, WIMP will send you emails of its new IP address, which could help you in tracking it down. You can change the interval at which it will check your IP address, and if you're worried that your system will be bogged down by the constant checking, put those worries aside. WIMP uses a very small Unix cron job, which is tech geek speak for very efficient. The cron job does connect into the Greenkeeper software website to check the IP address, and that's necessary because you might have a firewall that masks your local machine's IP, and it needs to send your external IP instead. Their server does discard the IP address as soon as it sends the email to you. If you have a laptop, you probably move it within a couple of locations, and WIMP even has an allowance for that. It will send each IP address once, and until those don't change, you won't get a message again. I installed the 920 kilobyte, that's kilobyte, not megabyte, WIMP application, entered my email addresses, and WIMP asked permission to run a test. It instantly came back and said, "Did you get the email? Huh? Did you get it yet?" It's like, "Whoa, dude, haven't even checked my mail yet." So I ran over and I checked my mail, and it wasn't there. And I checked again, and I said, get my mail, and I wasn't getting it. So I fiddled around for a while, and I finally broke down and read the FAQs on the site, and that's when they said, make sure your emails aren't being filtered into your junk mail folder. Duh, that's where they were. So now WIMP's main function, you need to understand, is not to provide theft assistance, but it could be of some help if that does happen. In the meantime, this looks to be a sweet solution to the problem of changing IP addresses. Research Department Niraj's next tool is called WITCH, W-I-T-C-H, from petermaurer.de. You might remember Peter Maurer as the author of TextPander, one of my favorite pieces of shareware. It's the one that lets you type just a couple of characters to type in any set of information you like, such as your signature or a paragraph you have to repeatedly type. I use TextPander to put my signature on emails, to put my address into the show notes, things like that. WITCH is a new application, which is Donationware, and it's a Mac system preference pane that helps you to switch to a specific window in an application using a keystroke. That might sound kind of confusing, but in contrast, Exposé lets you switch windows, but it's kind of clumsy trying to get to a particular window. You can use Exposé to switch between applications, but which takes you down a level to the actual window within an application. It also lets you directly access minimize windows without using your mouse, close minimize windows without bringing them to the front, and zoom, de-minimize, and close windows on the fly. I downloaded and double-clicked on the preference pane file for Witch, and it brought up system preferences quickly with it already installed. I was immediately overwhelmed by the numbers of toggles and choices. I kind of like this simple approach. They may have built too much capability in here. I'm thinking, how many triggers will I be able to remember anyway? Oh well, I decided to dive in anyway. First, I had to open the Universal Access pane and make sure I had enabled Access for Assistive Devices. Of course, I already have it enabled so that I can use the great application Quicksilver. I took another look at the triggers, and it turns out they have only one enabled to start with, and that's called All Applications. But I didn't know what the trigger symbol actually was right away, so I started guessing. I was pretty sure the second one was Tab, so I pushed buttons till I figured out that the symbol they had up there was Option Tab. I figured that out when I finally hit Option Tab, and up on the screen came a very large translucent gray window. On that gray window was a list of all my open windows by name and sorted by application. The name they used to identify the open window is the full title of the window, which really helps to figure out which one is which. So if you're at a website like podfeet.com, it wouldn't just bring up podfeet.com in the list, it would say the title of the window. As I kept the Option key down and hit the tab again, it toggled through all the open windows till I got to the one I wanted. Then I released the keys and up popped the window. I was also able to use my right hand to go up and down the list with the arrow keys, or flip through the options with the cursor as well. Okay, remember when I said I couldn't remember any more shortcuts? Well, I went back in right away to see what else it could do. There's a long list of things you can do, but I decided the one I could use was a way to flip quickly through the open windows in the foremost application. I threw in option one for that, and it worked great. There's a zillion more options in the preference pane, two more tabs full of options, but I'll leave that to you to discover. I think Witch will become one of my new favorite utilities, so head on over to petermaurer.de and download Witch if it sounds useful to you. Remember, it's donationware, so do throw him some money if you like the tool. Between TextBander and Witch, Peter Maurer is two for two, so I'm going to keep an eye on everything else he has in there. Last week, Paige Isinger from the podcast Views from the Coop at twosmartchicks.com, that's the number two, smart, chix.com, she posted to the Tech Podcast Network about a crazy thing called the International Women's Podcasting Expo. All right, and all-female podcast expo isn't really what I mean by crazy. It's a great idea, but the crazy part is this whole podcast expo was actually virtual. There's some software called TC Conference from TalkingCommunities.com that creates virtual conference rooms in a Java applet. I know this sounds confusing, and it was too out of the box for me till I actually went into one. Picture the last conference you went to. Straight ahead, there's a registration desk. To your right, there's the exhibit hall, and farther to the right are the conference rooms. When you walk up to the conference rooms, they always have a nice schedule posted on a sign so you can figure out when and where the good stuff is. Well, turns out when you launch TC Conference, it's exactly like that, except it's a cartoon on your computer instead of real life. To the left of the registration desk was a green room. I've always wanted to be the one in the green room, you know. And you can go in there to test your microphone. I wandered in there first, and a lovely gentleman named Rob Anderson, who works for a company called Co-op World at global.co-opworld.com. Co-op World actually runs conferences like the Women's Podcasting Expo, and Paige works with Rob pretty frequently on these things. Rob was in Australia while we were talking, and he helped me figure out how to work in the conference rooms. I do need to back up a little bit to explain some limitations I ran into right off the bat. I tried to launch the applet on my Intel-based MacBook Pro, and it kept unexpectedly quitting. No worries, I have more operating systems to play with. So I launched Parallels and tried going in the conference room with Windows. I got in, and I met Rob. I could hear him loud and clear. The only problem was I could only text chat to him because he couldn't hear me. I tried a couple of microphones, and I couldn't get it to work. USB is still hinky and paralyzed in Parallels, so I wasn't surprised I couldn't get that to work. In talking to Rob, he told me that the Intel-based Macs do seem to have some problems with the Java applet. By the way, when I said most programs do run under the Intel platform, even under Rosetta, the one exception I've seen is Java frequently doesn't work as well. So anyway, I jumped onto one of my PowerPC-based Macs, in case the G5, and I got in and I could hear him and he could hear me loud and clear. I told him I thought the fun stuff was figuring this kind of stuff out. Enjoying the technology was the good part. He and I chatted for quite a while, and I got a bit of an understanding of Co-op World's vision of where these virtual conferences can go in bringing together communities of people who don't have time to attend a physical conference. Sounds really promising to me. You can hear, you can talk, by holding down the control key to take control of the audio. That's so people don't stomp on each other. You can see PowerPoint presentations and websites, and you can chat to different people in the audience or to the entire audience. You can do that through text chat, I mean. So on Saturday, I went to the actual expo, and it was pretty interesting. There were hundreds of visitors in and out, and I think one of the most interesting things was how it was really about the day in the life of a woman. One woman was in a discussion group, and she said, "Hey, I got to go scrub the kitchen floor. I'll be back when I'm done." If that isn't just the epitome of what a woman's life can be like. Throughout it, you could tell that women there were juggling the craziness of their daily lives and popping in and out to participate. I'm pretty sure that you can go to the expo libraries after the show has ended to hear the recorded conversations. And that's another cool thing this software can do. It records the text and audio for later release. So if you want to see if those are actually up there, head on over to podcasting.global.co-opworld.com. Click on the Visit the 3D Expo, then click on the welcome mat outside the building, and then go to the libraries to hear the presentations. At least I think it'll work, but I can't guarantee it. The thing I'm most excited about is the opportunity to meet Paige. She's a tech geek chick who's a Windows person, but with an open mind to learn about Macs. I think she and I could make a great team together. She also told me about a thing called BX Radio at bxradio.net/coolcast, which is a streaming radio station. Coolcast streams podcasts all day long, and Views from the Coop, her podcast, is one of them. She thinks she can get the NoxillaCast on there. Wouldn't that be cool? She's actually been a real radio DJ doing, not DJ, I shouldn't say that. She's been a real radio person answering tech questions on the radio, so she's got a lot of experience. I'd sure love to have more ways to have my podcast be distributed and spend some time with a smart tech chick and team up. We have big plans. Keep your eye on us. Well, with all this talk of putting Windows on the Mac, I may have never mentioned that you actually have to buy Windows in order to do this. The $70 Parallels package doesn't come with it, and neither does Bootcamp. Here's the shocking part. Do you know how much Windows actually costs? And this is a question for both Windows and Mac users. I don't think most people realize it, but Windows XP Home retails for $200 US. That's if you buy it without a computer. And if you want XP Professional, it's $300. Can you believe that? You'd think it would be at least discounted by now. I mean, it is 5 years old. It's getting a little long in the tooth. But the reason none of us know about this exorbitant price is because we usually buy computers with Windows pre-installed, and they bundle it into the price for somewhere around $100, $80 to $100. That version of Windows is referred to as an OEM license, or Original Equipment Manufacturer. Dell or HP or whoever you bought it from is the OEM. Well, now you want to buy a Mac Mini, where the low-end one is only $600 for the 1.5 GHz Core Solo. Not a bad price for a fast little machine. But now you throw XP Home on it for $200, and the price goes up by 30%. Well, that's because Apple doesn't have any kind of licensing deal with Microsoft, so they're not an OEM. There is a sketchy way to get around this. Some companies, like Newegg, will sell you an internal component for a computer, like a bracket or cable, and then declare that you're an OEM and let you buy Windows. That seems kind of dodgy to me, but you can make your own assessment of whether it's right or wrong. Last week, I stumbled across a completely legitimate way to get Windows cheaper, and that is if you buy your Mac through Mac Mall. Turns out they have the low-end Mac Mini for $574 US to start with, which is $25 cheaper than buying it directly from Apple. And then you can buy it bundled with XP Home for $694. That means you're only paying $120 for XP. They also have it bundled with XP Pro for $744, or $170 for the OS instead of the retail $300. So it's a pretty good deal. What's kind of weird is this pricing model seems to break down when you go into other models, and I'm not sure why. For example, they have the MacBook Pro for a substantially discounted price, so when they add XP to the cost, they add it to the list price, which makes the delta for the operating system actually more than the retail cost. Not sure why they would do that. I suspect someone hasn't checked out these prices to see if they make sense. The bottom line is if you're looking for a new Mac and you think you'll want XP to go on it, check out the bundles at MacMall.com. Well, it looks like that's going to wrap it up for this episode of the No Silicast. I sure hope you enjoyed the two shows from Ron David, and I'll talk to you when I get back. I should have a new episode out on August 6th. Please email me at allison@podfeet.com. You know how I love to get all these email comments, suggestions, and even corrections. You can also send me audio comments if you'd like at nosilicast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.